Good morning. So wonderful to be with you all. I feel that, you know, over and over again. It's just a real privilege and honor to be here. And also, I have such gratitude for the one-on-one conversations and just that real connection that can happen. And I'm just in awe of your practices. I'd like to begin by sharing an experience that happened recently for me that probably, in the scheme of things, was a small thing, but I want to share it because I really see it and experience it as a fruit of this practice, and a really important one. It was a, Tuesday afternoon, and I had, as usual, about, you know, like dozens of emails to get to. None from you all. Just kidding. I love your emails. I love your emails. A lot of things to do. I had to pick up my kids. I just had all these moving pieces. You know, life. And I had to run an errand. And I did it quickly because I then had to, you know, do all these things. And I was taking the bags out of my car at our garage. And we live in a townhouse. And so, you know, we have a lot of neighbors right around. And one of our neighbors, who's this lovely older gentleman, I think he's in his 80s. We're very friendly. I don't know him that well. But he came over to me and it was clear that he just wanted to schmooze. He wanted to talk to me about the holidays, and he was curious about my work and the kids. Lovely. Totally lovely. And I had so many things to do. It's so many things to do. And here's what happened. I noticed a hardening. I noticed in my body a turning away from my neighbor. For good reason. Right? I want to be responsible. I want to do my work. I needed to be ready for my kids. I'm not saying there was no reason. But I noticed that hardening. And I took a deep breath. I'm sure, didn't notice anything was going on for me. And I physically reoriented my body so that I was facing him. Because I had noticed that I was not only internally turning away from him, but externally as well. And so I reoriented myself towards him. I turned towards my neighbor. And I felt the hardening in my heart. And I held it with love. And I felt it soften, even just subtly. And we had a conversation for, 5 minutes. And it was a conversation in which I knew I was present. And it was a conversation in which I believe that he felt listened to. He felt heard. And I still probably got most of the emails done. But for those 5 minutes of the conversation, instead of feeling that hardening and that, as you know, I speak from experience, that progressive solidification that happens, you know, the longer you're in that conversation and the more you feel that pull to turn away, the harder it gets. And to me, it felt like a great, a beautiful, sweet fruit of my practice. And for me, it is that kind of interaction is one that I see as being integral to my practice. And it is, of course, connected to what we've been working on all week. When something happens that is difficult, that is challenging, that is frustrating, that's annoying, that's painful, that's hard, that's violent, what might help me use that experience as a motivation to open and turn towards, to soften and become more intimate with my tender heart, as opposed to taking that exact same thing and using it to turn away from, to harden, to fight. This, to me, is incredibly fascinating when I watch it in my own experience, in big ways and in small ways. And so I want to look together at some texts. I don't think we'll look at all of these today, this morning, but to look at some of these texts, because I think that these texts share or kind of open up insights into how we might experience this internally. So we'll actually begin on page 2. This passage from Deuteronomy, from Devarim, right in the middle of Devarim. And it's a fascinating passage, and we're not even going to read all of it. But it begins this way. Ephes, ki lo hiye becha evyon, ki varech yivarechecha Hashem ba'aretz asher Hashem elkecha noten lecha nachala l'rishta. There shall be no needy among you, since Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, will bless you in the land that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, is giving you as a hereditary portion. And it goes on. If only you heed Adonai, your God, and take care to keep all this instruction that I enjoin upon you this day. For Adonai, your God, will bless you as he has promised you. And I apologize for the gendered language. I forgot to change it. But this is just how the JPS translates it. As he has promised you, none will extend loans to many, you will extend loans to many nations, but require none yourself. You will dominate many nations, but they will not dominate you. When I was putting this together, I first created put this source on the sheet and left out verse 7. I'm sorry, verse 6. Because I thought, like, oh, icks. And it was so funny when I realized, like, oh, I'm turning away from this that's difficult. In a source that I want to use to talk about turning towards that which is difficult. That's interesting. Right? And I could have done it, and it probably would have been easier. But I'm glad I kept it in, and here's why. Verse 4 begins, in this idealistic way. Right? This is the ideal. And just to like look forward a little bit, verse 7, and we'll come back to 4 in a moment. If, however, there is a needy person among you. Right? So in verse 4, it says, you're not going to have any needy people. And then in verse 7, it says, you're going to have needy people. And this is one of a number of examples in the Torah, in our prayers. We've seen it in a number of different places in which we see, as Rabbi Jonathan Sachs points out quite beautifully in a number of places, both the ideal and the real being held simultaneously. Right, so we begin and we say, here's the ideal, people. You must build a society in which there are no needy people. That is what you must do. However, it's not going to work out. Right, and then when we get into verses 5 and 6, it's like we see that closely aligned with this desire for the ideal is a tendency to go into fantasy, right? So I have a sense of the ideal. Here's who I should be ideally. And that might very quickly lead to a place that is actually divorced from reality, right? I mean, if you read verses 5 and 6 honestly, I think none of us could deny that this doesn't happen. Right, this has never happened. Right, not only that there have always been needy people, but also that this kind of causal relationship between following the rules and then everything will work out, it just doesn't happen like that. Right? Has anybody here found that by following the instructions during this practice that everything, like, there you are, you've reached enlightenment? I mean, it doesn't work like that. It's a fantasy. And by fantasy, right, I don't necessarily mean that there's not a place for it. Right? Even the rabbis in the Talmud, interpreting the verse from the second paragraph of the Shema that Lisa offered the other day, right? If im shamoa tishma'u, if you follow my rules, you'll get rains in your season. And the rabbi said, wait a second, you have farmer A next to farmer B. Farmer A follows the mitzvot, farmer B doesn't. You're telling me that the rain only falls over the fields of farmer A and not over the fields of farmer B? This isn't how the real world works. We are not the first people to notice that. However, also as Lisa offered, there is something incredibly profound in honoring the sense of responsibility that's here. Right? There's a Zen teaching, you can use the North Star to help you go north, but don't think you'll ever arrive at the North Star. You can use the ideal for who you hope to be as a guide, but beware of falling into a kind of fantasy that you're going to get there very easily. So the story I shared about my neighbor is one of many stories that I could have shared, and many of them don't result in me being aware of my hardening and then softening, truth be told. And if you were to interview my family members, they would confirm this. However, we have a practice that uses the ideal of opening towards all beings, for example. But it works and it operates within the real. And so that's where I want to go now. Verse 7. If, however, and the Hebrew can even be read even more strongly, ki yihyeh v'cha evyon, could be read as, for you will have poor people. When there are needy people amongst you, one of your kinsmen, right, achecha, one of your siblings. And I'm thinking about Joanna's beautiful teaching about Cain and Abel. Right? Am I my brother's keeper? You see one of your kinsmen in any of your settlements in the land that Adonai your God is giving to you, who is poor. And then it says, and I put it in bold, do not harden your heart. Lo te'ametz et levavcha. And shut your hand against your needy kinsmen. Rather, hatoach tiftach et yadcha. You must open your hand and lend him sufficient for whatever he needs. We can expect that as human beings, we will have the tendency to harden. It's part of this human condition, and it doesn't come from nowhere. As Sheila was talking about this morning, right? We are protecting ourselves often. I find it incredibly painful to open my heart to the poor people around me. I'm sure I'm not alone in this room when I say that when I am practicing and I see somebody homeless on the street and I bear witness to that person, it is so painful. When I think about what might have happened and the kind of suffering that this brother of mine, this sister of mine has endured, that has led this person to asking for money on the street corner. I have no idea what their story is. I don't presume to know. But when I bear witness, it is so painful. I was just in one of the one-on-one sessions, I was sharing that one of the hazards of this work, like professionally, is that, you know, we're on the retreat and I'm practicing and I'm really on retreat and very, I kind of redouble my efforts in my practice since, as you know, like we're not sitting with you all the time. And so I know that when, whatever I'm doing, my walk from the one-on-one session to the bathroom, I really need to practice. And so I'm opening, just like you are. And I have to do some emails and other kinds of work. And so last night I looked at the New York Times, and it's not like anything so radically different than what was happening in the world. You know, before we came on retreat, it was happening. But I read a couple of articles about this world, and I just started crying, just crying. What happens when we actually open ourselves to the suffering in this world? It is no surprise that we harden our hearts because it is so painful. And so that's why the Torah says you need to be aware of this and you need to actively cultivate your capacity for softening. Lo te'amet et levavcha. Don't harden your heart, which means you're going to harden your heart. Right? So we should come to expect this. And then our hardening our heart is directly related to what comes in the next clause. You must open your hand. Our capacity for doing and giving and being present and, actually responding to the needs of the people in this world and to this world, this earth, depends upon our capacity to open. My wife often quotes her father, my wonderful father-in-law, Mordechai, who had, I guess their whole childhood, he would say, loving is doing. Loving is doing. And so I know that when I see that homeless person, it's powerful to love that person. It's powerful to soften and feel maybe some sense of that human suffering that that person is experiencing. But that is different than actually helping that person. And so I wanted to make that point very clearly, because I'm sure the other teachers are on the same page as me on this. This internal practice that we're doing here should find its way out into the world, actually. Loving is doing. Right? It's not only doing. Right? And one other problem is that if we only try to do, there are all kinds of problems with that as well. But what are actual ways in which my hardening and my closing keep me from opening my hand and giving and responding? So let's skip to verse 10. Give to him readily. Naton titen lo. And have no regrets when you do so. Again, because you're going to have regrets. Right? You're going to give and then you're going to regret. You're going to open and then you're going to close. This is the human condition. And when we come to have this realistic expectation of that, as opposed to the ideal, then we can actually practice. Then there's something to practice with. For there will, going to verse 11, for there will never cease to be needy ones in your land, which is why I command you, patoach tiftach et yadcha le'achicha. Open your hand to the poor and needy kinsmen in your land. So one thing we notice throughout this passage, and there is so much in this passage, is that there's a repetition of these compounded verbs, right? Like patoach tiftach, right? Or naton titen. You shall surely open, or you shall readily give, as is translated here. And Rashi, if you just flip the page for a second, see kind of in the middle of the page, Rashi says on petoach tiftach, afilu kama pa'amim, meaning even many times. And this is a trope that he has kind of in a number of different places, building on the Midrash, which says that when we see these compounded verbs, these verbs in the Hebrew which double themselves, it means over and over and over again, you must do this. Right? It's, again, like that ner tamid, which could possibly be something we like screw in the light bulb, turn it on, and never think about it again. As opposed to this ongoing practice, remembering to remember, opening and opening and opening, and being aware that even as we open, we will soon close, most likely. And so we see this is a practice. This is a practice. Another thing that we see in here, and you know, to really build on Jeff's beautiful teaching and Joanna's beautiful teaching, the sense of the relational aspect of this practice. You know, there are still people out there who accuse meditators of navel gazing. You know, oh, you meditators, you just like deal with yourself. You're just concerned with yourself. But we know that this practice is about working on ourselves so that we can be present to the other in that I-thou, in that relational way, with a different quality of being. And so it says over and over again, it doesn't just say, you will open your hand to another person. It says, your kinsman. As if to answer that call, am I my brother's keeper? Yes. Yes. Yes, you are your brother's keeper. And that is not easy. Because it is painful. And so you will protect your heart by hardening your heart. Lo te'ametz et libecha. Don't harden your heart. So on the bottom of page 2, we'll see one of the Al-Chitz from Yom Kippur. And it struck me this year as I was doing this in shul, right, tapping my chest. Ve'alchet shechatanu lefanecha be'imut halev. It's the second one in the list. For the sin that we have sinned before you through having a hardened heart. It's the same root, imut halev, is just what it says, again in the bold, lo te'amitz et levavcha. Don't harden your heart. And so we find ourselves on Yom Kippur acknowledging, I have hardened my heart. However, struck me this year, turn the page over please. From the very beginning of Elul, I had been saying Psalm 27, which at the end it says, Kave el Adonai chazak v'ya'ametz libecha. V'kave el Adonai. Look to Adonai, be strong and of good courage. It's translated here. Look to Adonai. Right? And you see in the bold, it's the same word. Good courage, be strong. I had some fun looking up this root and following it around the Tanakh. And indeed, you see how it's used in a positive way. Strengthen yourself. Sort of a parallel to the word chazak. Be strong. We see this a lot in the book of Joshua. Chazak ve'amatz. Be strong and of good courage, it's usually translated. But then in a few places, like we have in Deuteronomy, it's used in a kind of cautionary way. You will harden your hearts, and that's not a good thing. And so it raises the question, and I'm not nearly as interested in the sort of issue of the grammar or of the word itself. I'm interested in the actual human experience that's reflected by this really interesting attention. When do I need to harden myself, to strengthen myself, to protect myself? Because we live in a world that can be scary, right? We live in a world that is in so many ways broken. And when does that hardening cut me off from the other? When does that hardening estrange me from my own heart and from my own lived experience as a human being that walks around this world with this tender, raw, complicated, wounded heart? The larger context of Psalm 27 is helpful for me in this regard because it paints a world in which we are so aware of the precariousness of our existence. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom then shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Anybody who's saying that is afraid. When evil men close in on me to devour my flesh, it is they, my enemies and foes, who stumble and fall. This is coming from a place of intimacy with the precariousness of this human life. And the preciousness and the precariousness of the lives of those we love. It comes from a place of awareness, as it says, Ki avi ve'imi azavuni. For my father and mother have abandoned me. And so, because that is part of this human experience, we need the line at the end which says, strengthen yourself. Be strong. And so, I find this actually quite encouraging. Because when I notice hardness within myself, I'm able to forgive myself from the beginning. I don't remember who said that at the outset of our retreat, right? Forgive yourself from the start. Because when I find that hardness, it's not because I've failed as a human being to live up to my ideal, but it's because I'm a human being. And the more and more intimate I can become with my patterns of hardening, with the ways in which my hardening is maladaptive, the better I'm able to actually soften and open when it's appropriate. And so it's quite a complicated picture. It's not just opening is always the way to go. As Rabbi Alan Liu of Blessed Memory writes about in Be Still and Get Going, he says it's helpful to ask two questions. The first is this ever true? And the answer to that is usually yes. Right? Is this idea ever true? Is it ever true that I should soften and open? Absolutely. The second question is this always true? And the answer to that is no, almost always. There are ways in which we need to strengthen ourselves and protect ourselves to survive. And it is not a failure as a human being when we do that. And how might that keep us from being alive in the most robust way? How might that keep us from living lives of holiness? How might that keep us, that hardening, from opening our hearts and opening our hands to those who are in need of our help? So please look at page 3. You see towards the bottom. This comes from the Talmud in Masechet Ta'anit. And the larger context is about blessings and curses. And the Talmud is contrasting blessings and curses that involve the cedar and the reed. And so it says, as this reed stands in a place of water, and its shoots replenish themselves when cut, and its roots are numerous, and even if all the winds in the world come and blow against it, they cannot move it from its place. Rather, it sways with them until the winds subside, and the reed still stands in its place. The Talmud is picking up on a curse in which, I forget who it is, curses the Israelites that they'll be sort of puny like a reed. But the Talmud is saying, that's not a curse, that's a blessing. To say that you should be like a reed is saying, your roots are deep, and you're flexible, and you move with the wind. If anybody, one of the great things about having the one-on-one room over there is I'm sitting with my back to the window, and there are all these bamboo outside that window. And as it's been quite windy, I can hear it on the windows moving. And when I turn around, I see this kind of reflected in the face of the people I'm speaking to, because we're talking, and then they're like, "Whoa," because those bamboo are incredibly dramatic. The wind comes, and they move feet. Right? And as we know, people take bamboo and build, you know, scaffolding with them. It's incredibly strong. And it moves because it's deeply rooted. And we'll come back to that in a moment. And, right, then it talks about a blessing, which is like you should be like a cedar. And the Talmud's like, wait, cedar? As the cedar does not stand in a place of water, and its shoots do not replenish themselves, and its roots are not numerous, when all the winds in the world blow against it, or even if all the winds in the world blow against it, they will move it from its place. Oh, I'm sorry, they will not move it from its place. Once the southern wind blows against it, it uproots the cedar and turns it on its face. And so in the land of Israel, the cedars that people were familiar with, right, we talk about the cedars of Lebanon, these beautiful, huge trees. The temple was largely constructed from planks of wood from these massive, majestic trees. Still on the flag of the country of Lebanon, the cedar of Lebanon. But it would grow in mountainous, rocky soil, far from water. And people noticed that typically the winds come from the west and the south. I'm sorry, and the north. The west and the north. Right? So I'd be like a yoga teacher. Right? Coming from the west and the north. So confusing. I don't know how yoga teachers do that. But the wind is coming from the west and north, or like a weatherman, right? It's a cold front coming in. And the cedar is very good at sort of defending itself and bracing itself against the typical winds. The typical winds. However, people would find that when a somewhat unusual southern wind would come, as the Talmud says here, these massive cedar trees would sometimes fall over. And the southern wind wasn't necessarily super strong. It was not as strong as the typical, western or northerly wind. And when cedars would fall down, they would see that the cedars had very shallow roots because the soil was quite rocky. And they were spread out, but only really in two directions. To brace the tree from the typical winds. And so here the Talmud is saying, don't be like a cedar. Or maybe it's saying, you're going to be like a cedar. So beware. We harden ourselves vis-a-vis the sort of winds that we expect, that we have come to expect. And that makes sense, because we're human beings, right? So when my neighbor came to me, I found myself hardening because I was kind of expecting this. It's happened before. I didn't want to waste my time, right? And I'm putting that in quotes because, of course, being present to my neighbor is not a waste of time. But I'd found myself accustomed to hardening in a certain way, to a certain person, right? You see the name come up on your phone, and you harden because you expect, oh yeah, I know this wind. I need to brace myself. I'm going to harden my heart. So maybe it makes sense when I see the homeless person, or when I read about Ebola, or whatever it might be, because it is painful, I think I have to harden myself. But maybe it's not so much the case. Right, and so the Talmud continues. And not only that, but the reed merited that a quill is taken from it to write with it a Torah scroll, the prophets, and the writings. And then there's a beautiful story, which I skipped, but then it comes back again with the reed and the cedar. A person should always be soft like a reed and should not be stiff like a cedar. Le'olam yehe adam rach kikaneh, ve'al yehe kasheh ke'erez. And therefore the reed merited that a quill is taken from it to write with it a Torah scroll, tefillin, and mezuzot. The instrument for bringing holiness into the world, as symbolized here by that which is used to write these sacred scrolls, is the orientation of the reed, not the cedar. That orientation of being both deeply rooted, but also flexible and moving, able to move with the winds, whether it's a westerly wind or a southerly wind, whatever. And that capacity to move with the wind comes from being deeply rooted and connected to water, right? This life giving substance with our which our tradition, I think not incidentally, equates with Torah. We could think about it as this living wisdom, right? When we really deepen our roots, as we are doing here, breath after breath, moment after moment, we are deepening our capacity to be in a world that is incredibly windy. And so one last text. I might go like 2 minutes over, so I appreciate your patience. This is one of my most precious texts. I love this. Please turn to page one. Here's the scene. And this comes from the preface to Ein Yaakov, which is a late 15th century, early 16th century compilation of sort of the stories from the Talmud. And the context of the story is, like the picture that we're asked to imagine, is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the kind of the head rabbi, has three students around, and he says, like, quick, hey Ira, what is the most important verse in the Torah? It's like a great question. Hey, what's, you know, quick draw. Ben Zoma said, and Ben Zoma we know is a great mystic, I have found a verse that contains the whole of the Torah. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. It's a great answer. And maybe an answer that many of us would have given. I would have. The second student, Ben Nanas, says, I have found a verse that contains the whole of the Torah. Ve'ahavta le're'acha kamocha. You will love your neighbor as yourself. Also a tremendous answer. And it's the verse that has come up more than any other verse over this retreat that we have been really entering into in a number of levels. It's an essential verse. It's a great answer. And then Ben Pazi says, I have found a verse that contains the whole of the Torah. You will sacrifice a lamb in the morning and another at dusk. And it occurs twice in the Torah. I would not have thought of that one. And then Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, their master, stood up and declared, the law is according to Ben Pazi. And so Emmanuel Levinas builds on this, great French Jewish philosopher. And just going to pick up on, there's a lot in this passage, but I just want to pick up on a few things real quickly. The second paragraph, the way that leads to God therefore leads, ipso facto, by that very fact, and not in addition to the human. And the way that leads to the human draws us back to ritual discipline and self-education. Its greatness lies in its daily regularity. Right? So Levinas is saying, if you want to go to the one, Ben Zoma, you first have to go to your neighbor. We shouldn't sacrifice the proximate other, as Levinas says, for the ultimate other, which is a pitfall in the spiritual life. I can ignore you, my neighbor, because I have more spiritual things to do. And he says, here's a passage in which three opinions are given, the text we just read. The second indicates the way in which the first is true, and the third indicates the practical conditions of the second. So to unpack that, the way we get to Shema Yisrael is through Ve'ahavta le're'acha kamocha. The way you get to the one, according to Levinas, is through loving your neighbor as yourself. But having the abstract notion of loving your neighbor as yourself is nothing without bringing a lamb in the morning and a lamb in the evening, meaning showing up moment after moment, breath after breath, cultivating an ongoing practice of avodah. And so by bringing awareness moment to moment and softening and cultivating a softening towards ourselves, as we notice, like, the coffee doesn't taste good, and as we notice, like, somebody's coughing, whenever we notice hardening in little ways, that is like bringing this lamb in the morning, the lamb in the evening. We do it regular, ongoing practice, tamid. And it's through that that we build our way to Shema Yisrael. And just to close, he says, Levinas says, the daily fidelity to the ritual gesture demands a courage that is calmer, nobler, and greater than that of the warrior. And so we need tremendous courage to engage in this practice of opening and softening. We do it moment after moment, day after day. And thank God we don't have to do it alone. We're in it together. So let's just sit for a minute.